Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie. Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
On May 17, 1974, three bombs exploded in Dublin and a fourth in Monaghan, killing 33 people and injuring 300 others. Next week will mark 50 years since those terrible atrocities, and to coincide with this, RTE will release a special six-part radio series to remember those events. The Forgotten, from Barry Lennon and Kieran O'Connor, starts at 6:30pm this evening here on RTE Radio 1 and continues this week and next week. To hear more about the series, I'm joined here in studio by RTE reporter Barry Lennon. I should warn listeners that in revisiting the day of the bombing, some of Barry's contributors go over their memories of some of the distressing scenes on the day, so we'll advise discretion on this. So Barry, back on the day, May 17th, 1974, just another ordinary Friday evening when these four no-warning car bombs went off in both Dublin and Monaghan.
That's it, and 50 years ago it is next Friday since the deadliest massacre in the history of the Troubles. Friday evening rush hour in Dublin, people heading home for the weekend, getting ready for parties, families preparing, of course, for Holy Communion, and the streets even busier than usual due to a bus strike that day in the capital. Three deadly bombs in the space of just 4 minutes. 1728 on Parnell Street, among those killed, an entire family, the O'Briens, who lived on nearby Gardiner Street, Anna, Johnny, 17-month-old Jacqueline, and 5-month-old Anne Marie. And Anna's sister Alice tells us in the series how her sister could only be identified subsequently by her earrings. A second bomb, 1730 on Talbot Street, at a time when many people were heading out of Dublin for the weekend towards Connolly Station. Among those caught up there, three friends, Josephine Bradley from Offaly and Marion Keenan and Anne Maron from Sligo. Anne was, of course, the aunt of my colleague Kieran O'Connor, all 19, 20 years of age. Josephine and Anne, they were killed on Talbot Street, but Marion Keenan miraculously survived. And then a third bomb at 1732 on South Leinster Street near Trinity College, just as Christina O'Loughlin headed home to her family from her job as a French polisher at the Shelburne Hotel. 26 people died in Dublin, including a pregnant woman, 258 injured. Then at 1858, a fourth car bomb exploded outside Greason's pub in the centre of Monaghan town, killing 7 people, including, for instance, 52-year-old Tommy Campbell, who'd come into the town from Silver Stream to collect his mother's pension. She died weeks later from the shock of what happened. And all these years later, people in Monaghan, they still vividly recall hearing the force of the explosion from as far away as Emmy Vale, which is approximately 12 kilometres away, and how the half-drank pints of Guinness still stood on the counter of Greason's even after the deadly blast. Now, the attack in Monaghan, it was largely regarded as a decoy to allow the Dublin bomb squad escape back over the border into the north unimpeded. Loyalist paramilitaries, the UVF, Ulster Volunteer Force, and members of the notorious Glenanne Gang, a loose mix of loyalist paramilitaries, RUC men and British soldiers, they were behind the attack, believed to be in response to the Sunningdale Agreement, which set up power sharing in the north back then. But nobody has ever been charged in connection with the atrocity, and questions of collusion between the loyalists responsible and British security and intelligence services, they've persisted over the decades. Questions survivors and indeed bereaved relatives are still fighting for full answers 50 years on.
And then after those bombs went off, Barry, there was those who were first on the scene. I think there are, you know, journalists who've talked about it over the years, the Irish Times photographer Tom Lawler being one of them. You've been talking, though, to Vincent Brown and his brother Malachy.
Yeah, I brought Vincent back to Talbot Street recently, and here's what he recalled from that day 50 years ago.
I was working in independent newspapers at the time, the Sunday Independent, and I'd arranged to meet my brother at the door of independent newspapers on Abbey Street. And I was coming down the stairs in the Independent, and as I got to the end, I heard a bomb go off, and I knew it was a bomb because I'd been in Northern Ireland for a few years before then. As we walked up Talbot Street, I was looking at windows that were broken and the odd car that was damaged. As we got up towards the junction of Talbot Street and Gardiner Street, I just was just utterly shocking. I sort of expected it to have, the bomb had gone off after a warning. Therefore, I was unprepared for the scene that we came across. It was around here that we suddenly realised that there were bodies lying in the street. I lifted up a young woman, and as I did so, she simply disintegrated. I didn't know that bodies disintegrated, but she was alive, but she disintegrated. And I put her down. Then we came across a big, tall man with a huge piece of metal on his side, metal from a car on his side. Lifted him up very awkwardly with the help of a stranger. And we took him up to what was then Mourn's Hotel, I think it's called. They wouldn't allow us leave him in the foyer. And they insisted we take him downstairs. And because we were holding him so awkwardly, we let him fall. Then we came back out, and Maliki was a final medical student, and we were looking for people, not who were dead, but who were still alive and who might be saved. A guard that was here said, there's another bomb about to go off. And we ran down there towards
Connolly Station.
And I tell you, we didn't know if there was a bomb had to go off. We didn't know we were running into the bomber, but there wasn't. I went back to Independent newspapers and wrote what I'd seen for the Irish Independent the following morning. We then went over to a pub called Daly's. We went in there. It was utterly silent. We were standing at the counter, and after a while, I realised that Maliki was crying, and so was I. We watched the Taoiseach Liam Cosgrave on television that night. It was shocking that the police effort to track down who did it was abandoned a few weeks later.
Did you carry it with you over the years?
Did it change me? I afraid not. I thought it would, but I don't think it did. But I don't think we know for sure. I was never involved like I was here. It was certainly a moment of great sadness and eventual anger.
Vincent Brown there remembering, indeed reliving those events on Talbot Street with you there, Barry. And he said the Garda investigation was wound down within a few weeks. What happened?
Police on both sides of the border wound up their investigations within weeks, as you say, Colin, with Gardaí abandoning their inquiry in August 1974. This despite Gardaí, RUC and indeed British intelligence quickly establishing an identical list of suspects for the people they believed responsible for the atrocity. The former British intelligence officer Colin Wallace, for instance, tells us how he had a comprehensive list of whom he believed involved within 2 to 3 days. But the Garda investigation, it was fatally compromised from the start. We hear in the series from Dr. James Donovan, the former chief forensic scientist for Gardaí, telling us how he only received debris from the Parnell Street explosion 3 days after the event, and he didn't know for 20 years afterwards that the rest of the debris from the bombings had been sent to the north for analysis. Files relating to the attacks, they've also mysteriously gone missing, including at the Department of Justice in Dublin, and the 2003 Barron inquiry set up by then Taoiseach Bertie Ahern ultimately concluded neither Gardaí or the then Fine Gael Labour government did enough to pursue the culprits. Ultimately, families, survivors, they're left feeling forgotten, even though they themselves never forgot the events of 50 years ago, including Iris Hall, who lost her father, Archie Harper, in the Monaghan blast.
It was a long sit and wasn't allowed up to see Dad. And when I did get, when I asked could I go up to see him, he said no, he was queuing for theatre. They asked me to phone Mummy and I couldn't, so I phoned a neighbour, and the neighbour took Mummy to the hospital and she nearly collapsed when she realised what had happened. I just couldn't take it in. And us both going to town to do our own things and this to happen, like, you know. Daddy, he lived for 4 days, but unconscious. And each day we were down with him, staying with him, hoping that he'd come round, but he didn't. And the day before he died, he put his hand out in my hand. And he opened his eyes. And he... I was hopeful he was coming out of it. But there was nothing could be done for poor Daddy. So that was my story. My life changed that day forever. He was so close to me, and I was so close to him. Went everywhere with him. My life has been horrendous because of this. You know, Daddy got it all in one side of the head, just the right hand side of the head, and nowhere else. But then, on the other hand, people say to me, you could have been caught up in it too. How was he killed and not me? You know?
The quest for truth and justice still ongoing.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
All I can say is it's been a long haul. I'm very blessed to be still alive. I'm telling you this story. My poor mother never got justice. And I don't think I'm going to get justice either. But there'll have to be some type of closure for us all.
That was Iris Hall there, Barry, who lost her father, Archie Harper, in the Monaghan bomb. The scars, indeed the trauma, clearly still very fresh in her life. What investigations are there now in relation to the bombings? Because I suppose even at the time, people would have realised that the loyalist paramilitaries would not have been capable of an act like this, nor were they afterwards.
Neither before nor afterwards. And indeed, some of those involved in the Dublin Monaghan bombings were involved in the Miami Shoban massacre, where their own bomb would ultimately explode on themselves. So the sophistication of the attacks raised questions from the off. And Judge Henry Barron, he concluded in his inquiry how it was neither fanciful nor absurd to believe collusion was at play in the Dublin Monaghan bombings. But his inquiries and others, they've been hindered by this refusal by the British government to hand over intelligence documents about possible collusion between the British state, police and loyalist paramilitaries. The Dáil, it has unanimously passed a motion on three separate occasions for the British government to release these files and to have them independently assessed. Now, there is a high level British police investigation, Operation Denton. It's expected to report later this year into the notorious Glenanne gang, that mix of RUC soldiers and paramilitaries. It's similar to the Operation Canova exercise we had earlier this year into the activities of Steak Knife and families. They're anxious to see whether this inquiry gets access or has gotten access to those British files, as well as key documents from An Garda Síochána, a Northern Ireland Police Ombudsman investigation also underway as well. But for Sean Donlan, former Secretary General at the Department of Foreign Affairs and head of the Northern Ireland Division at the time of the bombings, the refusal by Britain to release those files before now raises serious questions.
As the years have gone on, my view that collusion was involved became stronger, mainly because I began to learn much more about what was Harold Wilson's approach when he became Prime Minister in February of 1974. If his approach was as radical as considering complete British withdrawal from Northern Ireland, I don't think you can exclude the possibility that people at a senior level in the British system might even have authorised some collusion relating to the Dublin Monaghan bombings. I have a serious question at this stage as to why the British will not cooperate fully with the various requests that have been made from Dublin to release documents. I'm personally convinced that there are documents, that there are files. Why are they holding back whatever documentation they have in relation to Dublin Monaghan? My conclusion, for which I don't have 100% evidence, but my conclusion is they're trying to protect someone, and that someone is probably a person at a senior political level.
You said previously the level of potential collusion here might have went high up the chain of command within the British security forces. But now, all these years later, you're doubling down on that, saying it goes higher again, isn't it?
I think there is a strong possibility that it went higher, yes. I think the culture of the British system requires that if they're going to do something pretty radical, including collusion between the UVF and the British Army, and including the possibility that that collusion would extend to bombings in the Republic, I don't think that decision would have been taken either by rogue army people or by civil servants without some degree of authorization from a political level.
How regrettable is it for you that this is still the situation 50 years on?
I think it is an appalling situation, particularly for the survivors and indeed the relatives of the dead of Dublin Monaghan. The idea that they are not being told the full truth. It's difficult for me now to imagine who might they be covering up? You know, at what level? Who are they protecting? Or what are they protecting? Are they protecting something that they're ashamed of? Possibly that was illegal under international law? They must have a reason, given the ease with which they have released so many other documents. They must have some unusual reason for not releasing papers relating to that event.
And that was Sean Donlan, former Secretary General at the Department of Foreign Affairs. Barry, what we've heard from you so far is very much just a flavour of what you're going to be covering over this six-part series. Give us another taste of who else we might hear from over the next while.
Yes, so Kieran O'Connor and myself, we've conducted around 70 original interviews for this series, some people sharing their story for the first time in 50 years. For many, given the passage of time, it represents the last time to have their voices heard about what happened. And indeed, an open call out for people to share their stories in Monaghan earlier this year for interview. It provoked a phenomenal response. So a special Monaghan episode being broadcast tomorrow evening. Politically, we hear from the likes of Bertie Ahern and Micheál Martin, whilst former British intelligence officer Colin Wallace, he also raises serious and indeed fresh questions over what happened. We've written to those suspected of carrying out the bombings, those of whom are still alive. So perhaps we might hear from those too. And indeed, if anyone has any information or recollections they wish to share connected with the Dublin Monaghan bombings, they can email theforgotten@rte.ie or phone 01-208-2342.
And that's The Forgotten from Barry Lenehan and Kieran O'Connor. It starts at 6:30 p.m. this Tuesday evening here on RT Radio 1, that's this evening, and continues on May the 8th, 9th and 13th, 14th and 15th. It'll also be available gradually wherever you get your podcasts, so do look out for that. And if you've been affected by anything we've just discussed, you can find information about the helplines by visiting rte.ie/helplines. Back in a minute.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.